ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just one day after Jack McLennan's relationship fell apart, he vanished.
I couldn't believe this was happening.
Immediately, accusations started flying.
You need to cough up and you need to confess.
But it soon became clear there was so much more to the story.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, would you listen to that? I mean, just spontaneous applause. Hello there. Welcome to The Minefield, a show where we try to make the familiar strange and the strange familiar. How about that?
High five.
For a very different way of starting the show. I'll explain maybe why I said that in a second. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host as we come to you live from the Sydney Writers Festival at Carriageworks on Gadigal lands. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed.
I opened with the familiar strange and the strange familiar. Do you remember where that came from? Do you have any recollection? You're looking at me in the most quizzical way.
I mean, I know that I've said it.
Yeah, so I happened to be listening to one of our old shows the other day, which
what were you doing?
I was really bored. And I, and because, you know, normally I start the show by saying where we negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. And I said, I really don't like that. Mm. And I've been looking for an alternative. And you volunteered that alternative, and I'd completely forgotten you'd done it. And so now there we go, I've done it.
Well, I will just say that you often quote me without acknowledgement.
Is that right?
Yep. It's really good to hear you actually, you know.
Acknowledge.
Yes, put me in a footnote.
That's, yeah, right.
That's good,
okay.
I'm happy.
I'm sorry I do that.
No, it's fine.
I guess, you know.
We've been doing this for 12 years. If something hadn't rubbed off, I'd
be
really.
Sometimes you just forget what you're actually, your own thoughts actually are. So today's topic, I mean, you normally set up the topic. I don't know how you want to do it other than to say this is incredibly prescient is probably the best word to use to describe it at the moment. If you had to conceive of our political moment, well, it's so fracturing and so fractured that there are many, many ways you could do it. But I think today's topic probably captures the heart of perhaps the inspiration and the anxiety that so many of us are feeling at the moment. How do you want to frame it for us?
We're talking about nationalism, and let me just register my disagreement with the way that the show, this session, has actually been framed by the Writers' Festival.
Oh, I love this. Bite the hand that feeds us.
Yeah.
This is exactly... You should do it. It's
supposed to be talking about the return of nationalism. Nationalism never went anywhere. Nationalism is a pathology that is inherent to the condition of the life of a nation state. Nationalism as such is actually, we often refer to kind of atavistic nationalism, nationalism as an old hatred that has come back.
Nativism?
Nativism, atavism. Nationalism is a distinctly modern phenomenon. It is a pathology of the modern world. It's a pathology that emerges from the creation of, the invention of the nation state. So the idea that nationalism is something that kind of comes in and then goes out like the tide, I don't quite see it like that. If you want to think about the passions that unite and that complicate the life of a people together in this thing that we call a nation, nationalism, I think, can better be thought of as this strange bundle of emotions that's always beneath the surface. It's always there, and sometimes instead of coming out and going in like the tide, sometimes I think it swells. Sometimes it gathers steam and power beneath us, and then it bursts into the surface. It bursts into full view. If you want to keep using the beach analogy, it crests and it crashes. The question is, what are the conditions in which nationalism breaks into view? If you want to think about peaceful liberal democracy as being a symptom of peaceful, relatively prosperous times.
When you say it's a politics for that time, do you mean it is designed only to be applied in that moment? Do you mean it's a politics that promises that moment and that that moment will be everlasting? Are you saying that the minute we don't have prosperity, we have some kind of economic threat or whatever it might be, some sense of precarity, we're no longer liberal Democrats?
I think political liberalism does promise prosperity. and it also responds in kind to prosperity by reassuring people that there's room enough for us all, that there's not so much scarcity that there's enough to go around, that you can place jealousy, fear, hatred, envy behind you, or you can at least put it back on the shelf.
Even in difficult times?
That's the promise. But I think what's really complicated is that when things get scarce, nationalism, it seems to me, is born in the theater of threat.
That's when the wave appears.
That's when the wave swells and appears. This is the really complex thing, though, it seems to me, about nationalism.
Ooh.
That while it is a response to threat, it does two things simultaneously. First of all, it has to simplify the nature of that threat. This is where nationalism and populism, I think, do overlap with one another quite significantly. There is something about populism that is satisfying precisely because it simplifies both the response and the nature of the threat. So one of the ways that nationalism simplifies the nature of the threat is by bundling that threat together as at once an external threat. We are experiencing this scarcity because of that threat, because that external enemy, that external other is impinging upon our territory, constraining us or constraining the freedoms that we would otherwise have, constraining the prosperity, taking away something that should, could, must otherwise be ours.
This is the nationalism of wartime, or the nationalism of some kind of economic, say hypothetically a very powerful politician of a foreign nation was imposing tariffs on your nation, then you might have a nationalist impulse.
Sure.
Is that what you mean?
It is.
Okay.
However,
yeah,
nationalism is a Janus-facing phenomenon.
Yeah.
So it faces externally, the external threat, but then it casts that threat internally, especially when the neighbor, the threat, is not a proximate neighbor, is not a proximate threat. So then you begin seeing the reason we don't have this prosperity, the reason there isn't enough housing, the reason we don't, petrol prices are too, the reason these things are as they are is because something external has infiltrated us internally. Nationalism is the result of, and it is an internally projected vision of, the internal consistency, the identity of the nation. That's why I think George Orwell, I'm not always an Orwell guy, but on nationalism, I think he's exactly right. George Orwell described nationalism as a hunger for power tempered by self-deception.
But also a self-deception on what the nation can do. So I think about this in the context of, let's go straight to the United States. The way in which the United States wages war, for example, and we're seeing it now, and it seems to have become a tradition of the presidential office that you undertake a war that you think will be easy to win, and then you end up being bogged down in a war that you cannot win because you have overestimated the capacity of what your military might can do, either because when you're not in the office, you don't realize it, but then you sit in the Oval Office and you see all the magnificent toys that you have at your disposal and you think, oh, we're the most powerful army in the history of the world, we can achieve anything. And then it doesn't work out that way. By having a simplified sense of self, but also, what do we call it? Delusions of grandeur? A false sense of that self's own greatness.
A simplification of action as well, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's probably true. And an instinct in favor of force, on the understanding that that is sufficient and that you have that level of sovereignty. And it's twinned with this sovereignty thing. I'm a bit conscious of the fact, though, that in this whole conversation, I mean, we've launched straight into a conversation about nationalism. At no point have we really defined it. You've spoken about it in as something that only really exists alongside a Westphalian political structure. So the birth of the nation state gives rise to this concept of nationalism. But at the same time, you've spoken about it as a thing that's always there, as though it's part of an inherent thing in the human condition. So,
not the human condition. I mean, it may well be part of the human condition, but it's certainly part of the condition of life within the nation
state. So the Westphalian condition.
Yeah.
Okay. Aren't we really just talking about the Westphalian expression of tribalism, which is ancient? Or are you saying there's something peculiarly different about nationalism?
Let's just make another differentiation here, by the way.
Yep.
We often think of nationalism as a form of love of nation, a particular attachment to nation. But there is a form of attachment to what we could otherwise call the patria, one's own place, one's own people, the particular palette in which Australia is coloured.
So you want to distinguish nationalism from patriotism here?
I think it has to be, although I do see patriotism as a kind of way station on the way to nationalism. There are ways that patriotism, especially given the fact that we're around the corner from this orgy of self-congratulation that's coming with the United States' 250th anniversary on the 4th of July. I mean, there's something overtly patriotic about that, but in a way that is so ostentatious, that's so tasteless, that I think it actually tips over into something else. That's probably another conversation for another day.
It's a 4th of July show. We should probably do that one, Scott. That'll be fun.
But what I think is interesting with the nation, pre-Westphalian nations did have a certain degree of diversity within communities. Many people within those communities mightn't have had a claim on equality or recognition, but their place within that society was at least secure. Within Westphalian conditions, and here we're just talking about the invention of the nation state, where suddenly you no longer simply have a geographically or ethnically bounded group, but you have something where a claim of identity is impressed upon this group of people.
And made coextensive with political arrangements. Which are fixed.
Which means when you then combine that with, say, ethnic claims, where belonging to this community is based on ethnicity, or you have religious claims, where your secure place within this community is on the basis of your adherence or being part of the majority religion, for instance, then it means falling out of that community is disastrous. It's not that you no longer simply don't have equality, it's that you also run the risk of being purged from the community as a whole.
I think that's the tribalism bit.
It is, but when you expand that, and then when you add that to certain political arrangements, where the life of the nation is reflected in and safeguarded by the ruler over that, I think you do have a difference of order, a difference of extent, that ends up being a difference in kind.
What's the difference in kind?
Because I think a tribal chieftain is fundamentally different from, for instance, El Duce. A tribal chieftain is fundamentally different from a king, where the extent to which that king is able to hold sway over the extent of the well-being and the prosperity of the nation as a whole, I think you do have something that is fundamentally altered. And it does mean that the ability then to fall out of the nation, to be able to fall out of the well-being of the tribe. And it also means that the consequences of exile, of exclusion, simply become disastrous.
I'm just not sure I see the difference. The consequences of exclusion out of a tribal system can be disastrous as well. That's one of the reasons exile was one of the most severe pre-modern punishments, because it was effectively a death sentence. Anyway, maybe this is a dead end and we're just arguing over whether there is something essentially different or not. Either way, the political arrangement means that there is something slightly different about it. Maybe then it's worth grinding out, at least briefly, the very idea of the nation state, which you've spoken about there. But the logic, or the, I was going to say ethos, it's not really an ethos, but the characteristic that defined the nation state in the Westphalian imagination, at least, was its homogeneity. Mm. So we go from a pre-Westphalian period of empires, of borders being really not borders at all, frontiers. They would move. There would be military excursions to expand the frontiers or to defend them or whatever it might be. Often they were the same thing in the imagination of rulers because they were always moving. So if you weren't raiding, you were going to get raided, all this sort of stuff. Europe ends up in this situation with, you know, the 30 Years' War and the 80 Years' War and the 100 Years' War. Religious markers, identities and so on are part of that conflict. So the Westphalian solution is to say, all right, let's make the borders fixed. Let's establish a norm of sovereignty. You can't interfere with me. I can't interfere with you. Internal affairs exists now as a thing. So we'll just leave that to you. But in order to do that, I need to say that there is something essentially different about the people in this parcel of land from the people in that parcel of land. And let's say then that if we cast that forward into modernity, there becomes something in the imagination of the nation state. I mean, the clue is in the title. It's nation. So a nation is, you know, a people who share a particular essential thing, and the state. And the nation and the state become merged as the one thing. Nations have existed before states, or before the nation state, and states have existed before the nation state, but now you have them together. Okay, so we understand that idea. And what that should mean, and this was, you know, I've said this before, I'm sure, this was you know, Ulrich Beck's famous formulation of it. If I knew the color of your passport, I could tell you the color of your skin, probably what church you went to, what language you spoke, etc. There's an identity between, but identity in the sense of it being identical. And then the nations of Europe get born out of that. Of course, it doesn't make any actual sense. Well, sorry, that's not true. It doesn't reflect reality as it exists. There's a lot of linguistic and cultural and ethnic diversity within these nation states. Sometimes that had to be made real through the suppression of certain languages or minorities or whatever. But all this was pursuing what we might call the mythos of homogeneity within the nation state. Okay.
Which also usually involves the projection of a past. That yes. This nation exists not by accident, but yes. On purpose.
And that it's somehow natural.
Yes.
And if you want to see how this can play out in all sorts of very strange ways, probably you look no further than what the European powers ended up doing pursuant to this kind of idea, although with different motivations, I think, in the Middle East, where you have a whole lot of countries that don't really correspond to these sort of, what would you call them, natural boundaries, but get treated as though they should in some sort of way. And that plays out endlessly. You know, the disaster of the invasion of Iraq is an example of that. We can have that conversation ad infinitum. All right. But that takes us to a question that I think is interesting. We live in hyperdiverse societies. People of different cultural inheritances, people of different religious commitments or irreligious commitments or lack of commitments. So we live in this thing that complicates any narrative of homogeneity. In response to this grows up a new version of nationalism, which probably doesn't really deserve the name nationalism. Deserves not the right word, but you see what I'm saying. Which is to say, instead of regarding the nation or nationalism as an ethnic thing, let's regard it as a civic thing. And if you read the literature on this, the two polar opposites of this that are always given are there's Germany, on the one hand, which is ethnic nationalism, so ethnically nationalist that until, what, this century, you couldn't be a German citizen without a blood connection. So to be German was to be Germanic, and there had to be a blood connection. And then the opposite end was this civic nationalism idea embodied in the United States, where to be an American is really saying a political thing. You can have as many hyphens as you like. You can be Irish American, African American, whatever. But you're still American because the American claim is not an ethnic claim, it's simply a civic claim. It's a declaration of where your taxes go as much as anything else, or the rights that you have pursuant to or under the Constitution, whatever it might be. And yet we're having this conversation today, Scott, because of if we are to talk about the return or the rise of nationalism, we're really talking about it emerging in places like the United States, because that's what is influencing us. Does that mean the civic nationalism thing was always anemic? Does it mean the civic nationalism thing is dead? What is it about the conditions of the United States, which is meant to be civic nationalism par excellence? What is it about that that has given rise to what the Writers' Festival, in your view, mistakenly, has referred to as nationalism's return?
One of the fathers of the notion of what came to be known as cosmopolitan nationalism. Yes, cosmopolitan nationalism.
It sounds a contradiction in terms.
But it's actually not.
Right.
Is the 19th century Italian political philosopher Giuseppe Mazzini. He had, I think, quite a remarkable notion of what it means for nation to be nation and the various ways that nations can go wrong. If you think about, and this is a derivation from Mazzini, if you think about self-confidence or a certain degree of appropriate self-love as being the necessary condition for a human being to better themselves, to improve. If you think you're a piece of trash, chances are you're not going to do your best to engage in some kind of moral betterment, or you're not going to sort of strive too much to get your life together. There's a certain base of self-love, of self-respect, let's just call it, that you need to build on in order to achieve a certain aspiration. Mazzini saw a certain love of patria, a love of place, a love of people, a love of one's own, an attachment to a particular place, as not just the condition for nations to achieve a degree of contribution to humanity as a whole. And he actually interestingly saw the division of nations as being equivalent to or analogous to the division of labor. Everybody has to do their own thing, and by doing your particular thing, you contribute to the betterment of the entire situation. Mm. But as soon as that end of the betterment of all becomes decoupled, as soon as, to use the Augustinian phrase, as soon as nations turn in on themselves and seek their own betterment at the expense of everybody else, as soon as national wealth, national well-being, national pride, national accomplishment becomes a zero-sum game where I win and it has to be necessarily at the expense of other people losing. As soon as the telos of a nation turns in upon itself and it becomes self-reinforcing, both in terms of the nation's origin, we are here out of sort of sheer organic necessity, or we're here by providence, we're here because God put us here. When that then is met by, and the only thing that we have to live for, is our own self-serving, our own prosperity, our own wealth, there's something about the very idea of nationhood that goes deranged. You could even think of it as a form of almost group narcissism, where you are so detached empathetically from other people that their well-being no longer rates for you. You know, it's really interesting to me that Giuseppe Mazzini really did buy into a kind of Kantian idea that each nation, before it acts, should ask itself, if all other nations did what we are doing, would humanity as a whole be better or worse? And this, I think, is ultimately the most perfidious thing about nationalism. Nationalism breeds nationalism. If you are a nation that asserts itself over and against other nations, then it doesn't engender peacefulness or generosity on the other side of the border. It creates the same pathology that you yourself or one's own nation. The problem is when civic nationalism is predicated on the existence of a certain majority that has to be in power for the entire thing to work, it's very easy for that form of majoritarian patriotism or majoritarian democracy that is fundamentally either intolerant of or only tolerant of minorities insofar as those minorities stay minorities.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a bit of a problem with...
I know.
I think there are issues with the Mazzini formulation. What is there in that that is to prevent me from saying, well, therefore, if I go around invading countries that embody ideals that I regard as retrograde, I am doing something that all countries should be doing for the benefit of humanity? In other words, it disguises all these questions about what constitutes a positive contribution to the community of nations, shall we call it, whatever it is. I just think that there is something there that is so easy to overlook in that sort of formulation.
Well, I mean, here, Mazzini did put a very high premium on the importance of economic exchange. Yeah. He was very, very worried about the tendency of putting up the drawbridge of isolationism, effectively. Yeah. But I think he did place a very high premium on the capacity of civilizations or of cultures in conversation with one another, the ability of that conversation over time and in non-threatening or in non-antagonistic arrangements, yeah, as having ways of establishing connections that would give rise to mutual recognition.
Until the rubber hits the road, This is The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. We're live at the Sydney Writers' Festival, by the way, which is all sorts of fun. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. And we have a guest, Scott, and it's always your job to introduce the guest, but this time they get to come onto a rousing reception from a live audience, which is wonderful. Oh, we haven't even said his name. Now, this is amazing.
Ordinarily, we wouldn't actually be willing to share the platform with a nationalist. But if they happen to be a Canadian nationalist...
Yeah.
And a self-described reluctant Canadian nationalist to boot, I suppose we can maybe make an exception. David Moskrop is a Canadian political columnist and commentator. He's the author of the book Too Dumb for Democracy and of the forthcoming On Nationalism. David, welcome to The Mindfield.
I don't think you need me.
No.
I think I was just backstage furiously taking notes. I thought I had to rewrite the book.
Are you sure? Because you brought on a coffee, which makes me think you needed to be woken up.
No, this is bourbon.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, Canadians aren't allowed to be proud. We have to be apologetic by design. So we're not meant to be boastful. So it's an awfully curious thing when Canada faces an external aggressor who happens to be the global hegemon, a power with whom we cannot live without, but a power with whom we also can't live. So just to set the stakes, Canada, 80% of our trade goes stateside. It's worth about $800 billion to $1 trillion a year, which is pretty serious money in Canada. Defense integration, deep. Cultural integration, deep. Personal integrations, deep. And yet the United States is at once an aggressor, threatening Canadian sovereignty. And within a nation state system of sovereign nations, we think, well, hold on a second, we had a bargain here. We get to decide how we live over here, you decide over there. And so in Canada, we've had this sort of surge of a civic nationalism, which is operated at a commercial level. We're not gonna buy Yankee stuff. At a kind of cultural level, we're gonna boo the Star Spangled Banner. At a political level, the Liberals won because of Donald Trump. They were headed for extinction. And now there's a nation state building project going on in Canada. And at a kind of performative level, we're putting, I once picked up a can of gravy and it was called Americano gravy. And what makes this such a caricature is I was going to make poutine with it, which is a Canadian delicacy. And I marched it back and put it on the shelf and said, I'm not gonna buy American gravy, I'm gonna buy Canadian gravy.
Mm. Well, wow, the Australian applauding in the front rows.
And so there was this performative element to it as well, because at the same time, Canadians were spending more into the American capital markets than at any other time in our history.
Sorry, explain that.
So we were investing billions upon billions of dollars into the American stock market, into American infrastructure. We're building American Coast Guard cutters in Canada. The Canada pension plan, the state pension plan, investing heavily in America. But we were putting the gravy back on the shelves.
Yeah.
But so we're working through this. And this conception of the Canadian nation emerges. But it is fascinating because it is in response to an external aggressor, which you were talking about earlier. You need to have boundaries for there to be a nation within which to define oneself. But it was only in relation to the American aggressor. We didn't care about the rest of the world. And so we're now figuring out what that means.
But proximity has something to do with that.
Everything to
the
do with
that. The fact that it's on the other side of the border.
Everything to do with it. It is the world's longest undefended border for the moment. And so we had to figure it out. But here's why I think nationalism, as Foucault might say, isn't good or bad, it's potentially dangerous. The surge of energy, of identity with the nation, with the state, I should say, as such, or with the Canadian cultural community, is such that we now have a lot of capital. I mean, political capital, social capital, to get things done. We want to build the Canadian nation. And
sorry, can I just interrupt? When you say we, do you mean the Canadian government with respect to Canadian citizens, or do you mean in the world? What do you mean?
The Canadian government, but with the either tacit or express permission of the people. Everyone in Canada sort of agreed we have to do something now.
Right, so the Canadian government basically has a license that has been conferred upon it by these circumstances to do great public works, effectively, of nation building.
Yes, right. But in a fun twist that no one in Canada really picks up on, it's by private-public partnerships, basically underwriting private capital projects to build these things, but to call it Canadian.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some American companies will bid on contracts and get it. So you see the problem. But what's fascinating, and I think what is an important distinction between, say, a patriotism that is love of country as such versus a civic nationalism, which is a love of a kind of civic nation collection, is that there's a sociological grouping here, I think, of the Canadian nation, which is broadly inclusive, that's premised on values, on institutions, and on the conception of a welcoming country in which you can become Canadian no matter where you're from. And once you do, once you subscribe to these broad values, you're now part of this civic nation that has its institutions of which you can be proud. And now when you have this reaction to the United States, now we can start spending, both literally and figuratively, on building out the country. And so I think as a force, this nationalism is potentially very useful because it gives license to do great things.
Mm.
Or terrible things. And therein lies the risk.
All right. Here's my concern, though. I mean, I have concerns on all sorts of different levels.
Yeah.
No. That's not about what you said. Scott just has concerns.
Yeah, I just have concerns.
Okay. I am a doctor. Not that kind of doctor, but I am a doctor.
So one of the things that pluralist democracies have been struggling with forever is how to accommodate the sense of the substance that we need to share in order to remain diverse and yet together. This would be the principle of civic agreement that ensures that even though we come from different places, the bonds that bind us together vertically, that which we buy into, that which we assent to, that which we confess to be true, these are tight enough or thick enough that it sustains ever-widening diversity. But if you then were to retain vibrant diversity, so that what it means to be Canadian, what it means to hold on to the values that we can remain proud of in the face of who we are at this particular moment, at the snapshot of time, that what it means to be Canadian is left just enough open for redefinition. Yes. So someone who's affected me very deeply, the moral philosopher Raymond Gaita, said that there can be no conversation about, for instance, reconciliation in this country that isn't by reconciliation with Indigenous peoples, that isn't by definition open to redefining what it means to be Australian in the first place. Any civic conversation has to be open-ended in the sense that we need to be able to respond to that which constitutes us at this particular moment.
As opposed to an ethnicized conception of the self, which is biologically closed.
Either ethnicized or, as long as this majority remains in the majority, we're fine.
Yeah, yeah.
As long as everybody else is
same,
down
same
the
idea though,
same thing. So nationalism, by any name, with any prefix, adjoined with any other word, is still struggling, it seems to me, with that tension. How can we open ourselves to redefinition, given who we are at this particular moment, given the particular makeup of what constitutes this particular Canadian we? How can we hold on to that which we are proudest of and still be genuinely responsive to who we are at this moment? And this is where I think the predominance of hate of that which is on the other side of the border. It seems to me you can't have nationalism without a particular quantum of hate. And as soon as hate, as soon as antipathy or fear or dread of the other on the other side of the border, or the other than that's reflected within our midst, as soon as that becomes, as soon as that circulates within the national bloodstream, it has a corrosive effect. It is like a cancer within the political bloodstream in a way that I think most forms of patriotism are not. Patriotism is about holding on to that which we love most because it is what is most distinctly ours. The introduction of hate, I just don't see how it can be contained, even when it's directed against an object of as worthy of hate as the United States is.
Well, Canada has solved this problem. If I can go against
this
type,
is a very arrogant thing for a Canadian to say.
Canada has solved this because you're a student of Aristotle. So Aristotle has this conception of catharsis. It's sort of what acting is often. It's a cathartic way of expressing and sometimes expiating these feelings. In Canada, we just channel all that hate through hockey. And then it's fine. But I think you've solved your own riddle to a certain extent. Is that, well, how can you have these conversations about diversity and disagreement, and I'm a deliberative Democrat, and I believe all questions ought to remain open within rough boundaries. Hmm. You know, fascist comes and says, we want to be fascist. You say, okay, that's outside the boundary. We do that by saying, okay, well, we're going to fold that procedural commitment to keeping things open into our conception of the nation. That keeping these things open and renegotiating them through, say, the arrival of folks around the world, through adopting deep multiculturalism, nation-to-nation relationships with Indigenous people, that's actually part of it. And that constitutes one of these national institutions that we want to fight for and we value. And I agree with you that it does require a certain opposition to an external force, because it's driven by the fact that in this world there are certain ways of living that are different from place to place. Mm. But my argument is, as long as we're in a system of sovereign nation states, which we are for the moment, then we need that nationalism because it's baked into the sovereign state system, that we're not going to have a kind of single world government that can overcome all of these differences. I think the EU has proven that even at that scale, it's extraordinarily difficult to do, so forget about it at the world scale. And that national commitment to building out within a sovereign state how we want to live together and being proud of that is tremendously important and necessary. And if you were to change the whole structure, you might be able to get rid of it. But I don't think you can change the whole structure.
You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. The voice you heard there just belongs to David Moscrop, Canadian political columnist, commentator, and reluctant nationalist. We're live at the Sydney Writers' Festival. David, what you're saying, I think, will be difficult to accept for the Australian ear. Mm. And the reason I say that is we're right in the middle of that battle, I think, in some ways, yeah, in this country. And we don't share a border with the United States, and we haven't made an enemy of the United States in a way that makes us a rallying force.
Just give it some time.
Yeah, well, that might be right.
You'll get...
are you planning on dragging the continent all the way across?
We can use all the help we can get right now.
Yeah, fair enough. No, but so I think there's a very interesting thing that's been going on in Australia in the past, certainly couple of years, probably since the Albanese government, the current Labor government, took over. And that is that Anthony Albanese has been trying to instill a sense of and talk a language of progressive patriotism, mm-hmm, that I think very much mirrors what you're describing in the Canadian context. And it's not necessarily winning. I don't know that it's losing. I think it's hard to tell. But all the political energy is not there. The political energy is very much on what you would call the populist right. Exactly how nationalist that is, as opposed to just disillusioned, is an open question to me, but it's definitely there.
Can I ask you a quick question in relation to this?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, what's the premise of One Nation? Is it returning to a kind of, did I just swear in church?
No, it's not that.
Because it sounds, is it a return to a kind of pre quote unquote woke Australia or a white conception of Australia or a kind of British conception of Australia? It's, what's the premise?
It's very hard. It depends a little bit on what you want your question to mean. So do you want it to mean what has One Nation been talking about for 30 years? Or do you want it to mean what is it that's driving people there right now? And I think they're probably quite different things.
Okay, that's true.
So if you take One Nation at their word, I don't want to do a whole political history lesson, especially in front of a crowd of Australians who would all already know this, but Pauline Hanson is a disendorsed member of the Liberal Party, coalition, the Conservative Party, in the 90s. She gives a maiden speech in Parliament which talks about her fears about Australia being swamped by Asians.
Yeah.
That gets updated when she returns to Parliament in 2016, was it? Now we're being swamped by Muslims, but the rhetoric is the same. So there is a conception of the nation as an Anglo nation that lies at the heart of it. Very tough stance on immigration, really, really hates Islam and Muslims, wants a royal commission into Islam itself. That's the royal commission Muslims get in Australia.
Oh, my Lord.
So that's the language. Often polling around, 4-6%?
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly polling at somewhere between 20 and, let's say, 28%. But when people who are parking their vote with One Nation and perhaps even voting for One Nation get asked, depending on what figures you look at, let's say something like 17% of them nominate immigration as the reason.
Hmm.
Overwhelmingly, it's, I hate the major parties. I'm sick of the major parties. So I don't know, this is why I say I don't know what we're seeing here as to whether or not it's a nationalist moment in the sense of Australians returning to a blood and soil understanding of Australia in the way that you might say is happening within the MAGA movement, or at least certain parts of the MAGA movement in the US. The only reason I'm introducing this into the conversation is it's not clear that the version of nationalism that you're describing, which I would probably regard more as patriotism than nationalism anyway, but maybe that's a semantic difference, it's not clear that that will win in Australia or that that's carrying the day. Maybe if we shared a border with the United States, who had just put this these tariffs on us and was taking aggressive postures and saying they wanted to make us the 51st, or, well, after Canada, 52nd state, maybe then it would win, maybe. But I just fear that, and maybe the question to you is, what was the pre-Trump Canadian nationalism based on? Were you similarly battling with this emergence of a new version of a nationalism that wanted to reconstruct Canada in a more ethnicized way? Was that never part of the conversation?
No. No, so it comes in waves. Canadian nationalism has come in waves throughout the last century and this century. It goes dormant, but it never disappears. It's always there. And there's always a certain population percentage that is nationalist, right?
You mean in an ethnicized sense?
Yes. Yeah. So there is a group of Canadian nationalists that would be equivalent to One Nation that say we basically want to be British and white. They're very, very, they're ridiculous. Right. They're just utterly farcical figures. Nobody pays attention to them. They have no influence. But the rise of Canadian nationalism is almost always in response to the United States. In fact, it is always in response to the United States. You'll have nationalist moments in Canada, and this is going to sound like a joke, but this is true, in response to hockey. We'll have national hockey tournaments, and the entire country will watch. Yeah. The Olympics, for instance. And you feel the surge of a commitment around the country that is, we are one people, and that people is encapsulated by these guys skating around on the ice for 60 minutes.
Yeah, different sports, but I would say Australia is very much the same.
Yeah, and so that exists. But in 2015, Justin Trudeau wins. Remember, that's Katy Perry's boyfriend.
Yeah.
So Justin Trudeau wins, and he starts talking about a post-national state. He says that Canada is going to become the world's first post-national state. There'll be no core identity in Canada. And people reacted to that in different ways. Some thought, okay, this is great. We're post-national. We're great cosmopolitans. And some said, no, there's something here that's different. We want to celebrate that. But then Trump comes, and now we have to rally around the conception of a Canadian nation to resist the Yankee menace. The 1980s were like that, because we were discussing free trade with the United States. And there was serious concern that Canadian culture, Canadian industry, would become a branch plant of the United States, that our culture would be subsumed by the United States, that we would lose what it is to be Canadian, which has come to pass, that multinationals would flood in, that Canada couldn't exist as such. And what's fascinating about Canada is that within Canada, there are then regional nationalist movements, particularly in Quebec, predominantly descended from New France and French speakers, who think of themselves as a nation within this nation. And then there are the indigenous nations who preceded the settler colonial state of Canada by many, 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 many years. And so there are these sub-nationalisms. And so these intersect. In the 1960s, in the centennial in Canada, the same thing, we were celebrating the birth of a nation, but this was more about the point at which we have sort of decoupled from the United States. You have to understand that Canada is a country that was started as a commercial agreement, basically. And that commercial agreement started with the UK saying, get out of our basement, it's time for you to grow up. You've got to go, you've got to get your own job. Go make something of yourself, for the love of God. You can't just hang around in our basement forever.
No, they started Australia by saying, we need to send you to a different basement.
So you've been there, right? You've been there. You know, in Canada, the Supreme Court of Canada wasn't the final court of appeal until 1949. Yeah. We couldn't amend our own constitution until 1982.
Yeah, the similar stories.
And so, you know, this conception of Canada as such and as being a distinct people and a distinct state was first in response to decoupling from Great Britain and then later from the United States. And so it comes in waves, but then it dissipates. And that speaks to, I think your point earlier, it often intersects with populism, because when people get angry and mad or disaffected, it channels that way, and the rise of an external aggressor in a particular moment.
Yeah, but my fear with this version of nationalism that you're describing is that it might just be a bit anemic in a moment like this. And maybe Canada is not the case study for us in Australia to be thinking about, precisely because of the peculiarities of the relationship with the US and the proximity and the size. I mean, we're the economic power in relation to, say, New Zealand, which might be the closest.
Yeah.
But if New Zealand was a hegemon, we would probably have something more to talk about in that way. The thing about it is, saying we're basically going to dissolve Canadian identity for the sake of accommodating a pluralism which we will then hold together through civic bonds. I mean, compared to this is blood and soil.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not inspiring, is it? And so I think in a moment, to come back to Scott's, the way Scott set up from the very start, at a moment of stress, at a moment where the economic pact doesn't hold together in quite the way that we imagined it might. And you see this, I mean, the big cleavage in Australia right now is rural and city.
Yeah.
And why? Well, because rural Australia is not a fun place to live at the moment. Hospitals are very hard to access. Like, all education is hard to access. All the basics are not. It's ripe for the conditions of a MAGA style yep. thing. So that's part of the story. But the point is that the economic pact is kind of not quite holding in the way that you might have hoped. When there isn't another thing to hold on to, when there isn't some kind of overarching, here we go, just because this is top of mind for me at the moment, let's use quite a non-liberal way of thinking about it. When there's not some overarching sense of a common good, a common purpose that would be culturally informed, then you're going to get these movements that are going to invent it.
Yep.
They will invent it in a debauched way, which is what we're seeing in a lot of cases, and they'll be popular. They'll succeed. I don't know that the patriotism that you're talking about or the civic nationalism that you're talking about quite has an answer for it.
I actually think it's a problem less for nationalism than it is a problem for liberalism.
Yeah.
So
civic nationalism stems from a kind of liberal commitment, doesn't it?
Absolutely it does. And my contemporary critique of liberalism, let me preface this by saying I think liberalism is extraordinarily important both from the 18th century onward and to this day, that the value of liberalism has been a commitment to freedom, a commitment to law and order, to institutionalism, and above all, perhaps, to human rights. And if I can be a little bit particular, and we talked earlier, proud of my country for a moment, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms is a model for rights regimes around the world. And in fact, it was used in post-apartheid. So there's at least one Canadian in the audience. Which is,
I like that the clap was gentle and slow.
Well, it's translated from Latin, but that's our national motto.
Yeah,
gentle and slow. But it was used in post-apartheid South Africa as a model. That, you know, we have a deep commitment, but liberalism is thin because it asks very little of the citizen as a citizen. Mm. It basically says, okay, we'll leave you alone. You have all these negative rights. Maybe come vote every 3, 4, 5 years, but then go and be a consumer, be a producer, be an economic unit first, and a civic unit citizen or citizen resident, whatever it might be, second.
And don't tend to common culture.
Yes.
Don't tend to social institutions.
Yes.
The institutions are state. They're at the state level.
Yes.
They're conceptual.
Essentially get out of the way.
Yep.
And when push comes to shove, you find those bonds start to fray because liberalism is got a thin foundation, a weak foundation. And then I think that's when you get into the trouble you get into. And COVID was a bit of a case study. Now in Canada, during COVID, we banged pots and pans for people. Did you do this here? We were all in. We were going to bend the curve. The government was shoveling money out the door to support people. Inequality went down, by the way. Turns out when you properly fund the welfare state, people can live. You're not allowed to do that though, because it's called socialism. But so far so good. I have a friend who studies post-disaster societies, and we were on the phone. It's this woman called Dr. Yvonne Sue, brilliant scholar, and she says to me, "Just wait 5 minutes. Wait, what happens 5 minutes from now, when the scarcity picks up, when we're actually asking people to sacrifice? Wait till you see what happens then." Yeah.
And when the emergency disappears, that's the other aspect.
Exactly, the civic, those bonds dissolve, the foundation dissolves.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a fundamental problem of liberalism there. And so I worry about that very, very deeply, because I worry that when push comes to shove, especially with the climate crisis and potential migrant crises and other things, that we're not going to have the civic bonds and community and commitment to the collective that we need to sustain ourselves in the face of tremendous threats.
Well, the rule of thumb here is that essentially the political dispositions and habits that you take into a catastrophe don't get better or redeemed or elevated to their best possible expressions during catastrophe. They get sunk. The cracks begin to emerge. And I think, look, in fairness to liberalism, I wouldn't necessarily call myself a liberal. I wouldn't necessarily call myself a political liberal. I mean, one of the things that liberalism is supposed to do, though, during times of prosperity, is not to squander it. Times of prosperity aren't meant to just send people out to enjoy their leisure and to freely express their individuality or whatever. The times of prosperity, when there is more money for education, when there is more money to invest in culture, when there is more space for free and civic interaction, those are the very times when the things that we most believe in, that which we most profess to be true, that's the way that we make democracy a way of life, for want of a better term. And it's precisely those bonds that ought to attend to our democratic habits. You know, here's where I think John Dewey, who was a fierce opponent of nationalism in every form and opposed it in the face of both First and Second World War, here's where I think John Dewey could not be more pertinent for us. If you neglect the habits that bind you together with those who are proximate to you in relationships that can only be described as love, and the democracy itself is actually an expression of our loving care for one another, then during precisely those times of greatest stress, whether it's in the form of a pandemic or a threat on the other side of the border or a threat of invasion from another country in the form of irregular maritime arrivals, it's the things that most nurture our sense of aggrievement that are going to come most powerfully to the surface. And unfortunately, in the absence of democratic love, hate is always going to be the more powerful, the more compelling. And the problem is, it's the more binding emotion as well.
The clock is screaming at us, so I'll give you the last word, David, if there's anything.
Oh, no pressure.
This might be the last session people have at this festival as well, so their whole impression of the festival could really be shaped. I would just say, just take a breath. We've got a few seconds. Take your breath. And just give it your absolute best. Just take a time to knock everyone's socks off.
So we have a decision to make. We're either going to live together or we're not going to live together, because things aren't going to get easier in the years that come. They're going to get more difficult. And what I'm proposing is that we decide that we come together as a community. You know, you can call that a nation, or you can call it a polity, you can call it whatever. And we commit to broadly speaking, shared values, shared institutions that are open for debate and reassessment for sure. But the one final element we haven't discussed much, and I want to end on, material egalitarianism. Because I want to put something to you. If you have a right to something, but you can't exercise that right for lack of material capacity, you don't have enough money, you don't have time, you're a caregiver, do you really have that right? And part of the reason I'm what I call a reluctant nationalist is because I want to take the capital, the energy, the potentiality that comes from these moments of frustration and anxiety, and I want to take it up and I want to build something strong and great that can build a nation out of that. Not just a nation culturally, but a nation with egalitarianism that ensures that everybody gets through the day. And when you do that, you undercut all of the toxic elements we talked about earlier, and you create the conditions to build those bonds of love that can be sustained through crisis. And we can do that. We live in an era of plenty. We can do that right now if we want to, and we should.
How long would it take? Because time is critical.
Well, the clock's run past, so I'm afraid I don't have time to answer that.
I actually asked for that response, didn't I? David, thank you.
Thank you.
It's all right. Glad to hear it. And I tell you what, they mean that, because I didn't even ask them to clap at that point. They just did it. So thank you so much for joining us. David Moskrop, Canadian political columnist and commentator, the author of Too Dumb for Democracy. There's a question mark after that, by the
very
way.
Very important question mark.
Why we make bad political decisions and how we can make better ones, and also the forthcoming book on nationalism. Our guest for this week's edition of The Minefield, which has been live at the Sydney Writers' Festival. It's been wonderful to be here. We'll be back next week with, I guess, standard programming, and you can listen to us anytime you like on the ABC Listen app. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, David. And thank you very much for coming out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.